This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
You're listening to The Western Rookie, a hunting podcast full of tips, tricks, and strategies from seasoned Western hunters. There are plenty of opportunities out there. We just need to learn how to take on the challenges.
Hunting is completely different up there.
I harvested 26 big game animals.
You can fool their eyes, but you can't fool their nose.
300 yards back to the road turned into 3 miles back the other way.
It's always cool seeing new hunters go and harvest an animal.
I don't know what to expect.
If there's anybody I want in the woods with me, it'll be you.
Welcome back to another Western Rookie Podcast brought to you by Go Hunt. I'm your host, Brian Krebs, and today we're going to be diving into the world of archery. We've got Evan Williams on the call, and I would say, Evan, you know, we went back and forth for a while talking some questions about bow, and I kind of wanted to build on that conversation because I think a lot of the information you were sharing on bows are questions a lot of people are asking these days. I think it'd be a lot of good information for our listeners to go over. So I'm glad we got this to work out. We've had scheduling conflicts on both ends.
Yeah.
We are persevering through some technology adversity right now. So if anyone notices something there, we're doing the best we can, and we're going to make sure we can get this conversation in. But thank you for being here today, Evan. Thank you for taking the time to join the podcast.
Yeah, Brian, it's a pleasure. And yeah, sorry we had the scheduling conflicts we have between some announcements that came out on this morning's like little social media blast, and obviously with my schedule traveling for the TAC events and everything this summer, it's been crazy. So
yeah, you're a busy guy going to all the TAC events, and by the time this goes out, we'll probably be a couple weeks late. But you know, the big announcement that you guys are bringing John Dudley back to Hoyt.
Yep. We got all the final contracts negotiated, and everybody is super happy on both ends with where the brand partnership is going to be going in the future, and we just look forward to having John back inside the Hoyt family. And you know, it's always been something we've stayed in contact with him. There was no bridge burning or anything that happened. It was just an opportunity that he got presented. And, you know, if you listen to the Hoyt Bowhunting podcast, he kind of goes into some details on that. But it truly was something that at the time he couldn't pass up with the opportunity. And there were no hard feelings. It was a sad day. And we all marked our calendars because we knew how long the contract was. And you know, it's just one of those things you look to the future and you never know what it can hold. So it's speaks worlds and volumes when it comes to the approach and the way things are done, you know. So doesn't have to be a bad parting. And again, we're all friends, and you know, my relationship with Dudley goes back before I started working at Hoyt, and the same with, you know, our current president, Zach Kurtzall. You know, Zach and John and a couple of our engineers at the time, when John was at Matthews, like, they were competing against each other and have always had a good friendship, and it's just been a great fit, and we're looking forward to having that relationship and that family member back.
Yeah, it's really cool to see some of this changes, and you're right, like, nothing is set in stone, nothing's forever. Yeah, so it really just comes down, I feel like, and I haven't been in the industry nearly as long as basically anyone mentioned so far, but it's just, it's all about how you treat people at the end of the day, you know, like, hey, I loved you guys and I love the product, but I've got an opportunity here that I, you know, I'm really feeling I need to pursue, and I'm, you know, I don't want to burn any bridges, and just handling it well, handling it with class, because you never know, you might be back 5 years later.
Yep. Yeah. The fact. So then there's, you know, and when you're around business long enough, you truly need to take a look inside yourself as an individual and realize that there is a difference between a personal relationship and a business relationship. And one does not have any bearing at all on the other. It can be extremely hard to separate the two at times. If you can do that successfully, it's going to take you so much farther, because you'll be able to either look at something from another individual's shoes, or you'll really be able to go, you know what? This has no impact on our personal relationship. From a business standpoint, this is the approach that we need to make. Or, you know what, from a business standpoint, we need to dive farther this direction, or we need to dive farther that direction. So, yeah. And they can be hard to separate. You know, a lot of times people take things personally that aren't meant to be, and shouldn't be taken that way. And that's where feelings can really get hurt. But if you take a big deep breath and just kind of take a step back, sometimes it's a hard pill to swallow, but it's the one that needs to be done at times.
Yeah. Well, super excited. Either way, super excited to have Dudley back at Hoyt. I've been thinking, you know, maybe getting closer to the topic we want to talk about today. I've been thinking a long time about switching up, you know, a lot about my archery process, and it's kind of just maybe reflective of the whole, you never know who you're going to be partnering with or working with, but you also never know like what you want in an archery setup. And when I built this bow, I knew, you know, even less than I know now, which looking back, I feel like I wouldn't have said that, but you know, and I picked a bunch of things and we went forward and it works for sure. And we've had a lot of fun and had success, you know, with that bow. But, you know, now I'm finally getting to that point where I'm starting to really look at like, what is the best fit for me? And I really do feel like that's where the archery industry has gotten to. Like, the technology is phenomenal. I mean, my first bow, I still have PTSD from shooting that thing. Like, it was one of the hardest bows to tune and shoot, and you never knew what was going to happen. And now all the bows are so much more enjoyable than that. And like the last 30 years, the technology has gotten to the point where it really allows you to take some time and step back and be like, what is the best setup for me? Before it was like, here's a setup, you know, here's what we got. Now it's like, I can fine tune my draw length, and you can find bows to fight the right cycle and the weights and all kinds of stuff. And that's kind of what our conversation over email has been about, kind of fine tuning setups for the individual person. And some of the things that you had brought up, I wasn't even on my radar yet. And I really liked the insight that you gave to me. And I didn't want to gatekeep that information by any means, and thought it'd be a great podcast episode to talk about some of those topics.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, everyone is going to have a different mentality or a different mindset when it comes to building their setup. You're going to have the guy that, if he's an Eastern or just a whitetail in general bow hunter, but makes the occasional trip out west, he might want two different setups to play around with. You've got a lot of guys like myself, I want one setup for everything. So what are those good numbers when it comes to, you know, what is my front of center? How much weight do I want up front? What is a good overall grain weight? How fast do I want to shoot? what's too fast versus too slow when I'm shooting and going after antelope and elk and whitetail and mule deer. And, you know, I had a bear hunt this year, first time ever, and I'll be looking at doing turkeys. Like, if I'm trying to do all these different species with one setup, do you build it for the biggest one you're going to be hunting, and then everything else just gets whatever that setup is? Or do you make a couple concessions here and there? I don't like playing with broadheads either. You know, I might play with a couple different expandables. I'm lucky enough, I get a couple extra doe tags in some of the whitetail states I go to. So those are like product testing tags. Like, okay, I've got a 4-arrow quiver. I'm going to take 3 different broadheads. And I know on my buck tag, like, this is my number one because I know what it does. I've tested it. It has come through for me. If a doe comes in, I've got a couple of the broadheads I want to test. And that being said, I'm shooting some of those ahead of time too, so at least I know how they fly. So you have different mindsets and mentalities for a Western bow hunter versus a whitetail versus the one that wants multiple setups versus the one that I need one setup to do it all. And so you've got all kinds of different angles and arguments when it comes to every aspect of that. Arrow spine versus FOC versus broadheads. So, you know, take everything that I have to say with a grain of salt, because it's coming from, again, my personal experience and how I feel when it comes to putting together my personal setups. So,
yeah, it's I mean, we just did a video last night about the, you know, I just had Abby ask me, like, what's the best Western caliber for big game hunting? And knowing there's no right answer, and as easy as that gets with the calibers, because there's really only, like, you don't, there is no front of center calculations on a caliber. And so I'm like, hey, 270 win. If you got to do one thing that does it all. And then sure enough, we're at like 700 comments of people either agreeing or disagreeing.
Yeah.
And that's easy.
What about it? What about a 280? What about a 308? What about this? Like, with this round, you can have, you know, this grain weight versus, you know, a 270, you know, this is the highest grain weight. Like, I want the heavier grain weight up front, even though it's going to slow me down. Like, yeah, it's the same ballistic conversation. Cause then you, and again, on the firearm side, it's how comfortable are you shooting? You know, are you a guy that you're going to, like, you want your shot 400 yards and under? Are you a guy that has the proficiency you're shooting 500, 600, 700 yards? You know, I have a background in competitive rifle shooting. So for me, I don't shoot rifles anymore, especially hunting, because I don't get that internal fulfillment. I don't get that same experience.
Right.
Because for me, having a firearm in my hands, like, on the target side, I can do it. I don't feel like it's the same game.
Yeah. So, and think about how many variables there are with a rifle. With a bow, the variables, I mean, you're building your own projectile. You want to cut at 28 or 28 and a quarter or 29. Do you want this? And so wrap, the options wrap, just blow up. Yeah,
wrap or no wrap, 3-vein, 4-vein, 5-vein, 6-veins. Like, and yes, all of those vein configurations are possible, and I have seen all of them. And, you know, am I going to shoot a 1.7? Am I going to shoot a 2? Do I shoot a 2.3? Do I shoot a 2.2? Some have a 2.7. Do I go 3? Do I go trad and go a 4 or 5 inch feather and right versus left versus offset helical? And yeah, I mean, you want to talk about going down a rabbit hole. It can be overwhelming very, very quickly, especially to someone who's just getting into it or trying to make that transition from, I'm a big game hunter. I have been on the firearm side, but I want a longer season. I want to hunt some other states during the rut, or I just want to extend my season in general and give myself some other options. Archery is the next best thing, because most states are going to open, you know, out west around August 15th for antelope, elk, mule deer, depending on the state. And your chances are you're going to get to hunt through September. And then most of your whitetail states are going to open up first part of October, and they're going to go either end of December, or some have the late season where you're hunting January or even some into February. Like, but you get a rifle tag and you're a week, 9 days, week and a half, you know, that significantly reduces your options.
Yeah. And another thing is all elk hunting is cool, but there is no replacement for a bull bugling in your face at 30 yards. And you just typically don't get that experience with a rifle.
Yep. Or maybe a first rifle if a states have it where it's usually the middle of the first week of October and you might only get 5 days.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the big things that I see right now going on with the archery industry, and I think a big question is, I think you guys, unfortunately, and Cam Haynes have been major contributors to this question, but the 80-pound bow, I think a lot of people are trying to – I think you probably know better than me. I get a sense of Cam shooting a lot higher than 80.
His limbs and the build he has currently has the capacity to shoot 92. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, but the 80 is the common, commercially available, and a lot of people are wanting to go to 80. And I was one of those people. While we were kind of planning the podcast, we were throwing around some topics, and you know, I feel the question that you kind of prompted. Like, do you want to build a bow to do everything? Do you start with the most extreme case that it has to be able to handle, and then for whitetail does at 20 yards, you're just going to lose your arrow in the bottom of the food plot? Mm-hmm. And I'm very much of the mindset to do everything humanly possible to, you know, recover an elk, because that elk, those animals are so tough and they are so hard to find. If you don't make a phenomenal shot, really, there's so much going on there.
Most of us only get so many days each fall to spend hunting, which means when I'm out there, I like to make sure I have the best tools at my disposal for getting the job done and bringing home some meat for the family. That's why I've been using Go Hunt Maps exclusively these last few years whenever I'm outdoors. Whether it's back home chasing whitetails or out west looking for elk and mule deer, the Go Hunt mapping software has quickly become my favorite application for a number of reasons. Of course, they've got the incredible land ownership data, the private and public land boundaries, but they've also got a lot of really easy-to-use features. And two of my favorites are the species distribution layers that I can toggle on and off and make sure I'm spending my time out west in the right areas. There's nothing that sucks more than spending a couple days of your hunt only to find out you weren't even in the right part of the unit for where those animals like to be during your season. Another thing I love about the app is how they've implemented the hunts folder, where I can sort all of my pins and tracks for a specific hunt in a single folder. So right now, I'm working on my 2024 Wyoming rifle antelope folder, and I've got a 2024 Nebraska archery whitetail folder. I even use this feature back home chasing whitetails. I've got a folder that's called Whitetail Bucks for each one of my farms, and whenever I see a mature buck, I draw a line, and I've got it color-coded based on the age of that deer. So over all the years of hunting, I start to build up a log of data of where I've seen all of the mature buck movement, and it really helps when it comes time to be putting out next year's stands and setting up next year's plans. Go check out the maps, and you're really going to see what I mean about how it's easy to use. It's a great tool to have in your pocket no matter where you're hunting this fall. And the best part is it's included for free with your Insider membership, which means you only have to go to one place to get the best resource for the Western hunter. And if you don't have Insider yet, you can get $50 of free gear shop credit when you sign up using the code Western. That's right, they're going to give you $50 of free credit this fall for whatever piece of equipment or gear you've got your eye on. Go check it out at GoHunt.com, use the code Western, get a little bit of money back, and let's start getting fired up for season, because it's going to be here before we know it.
I'm, you know, accuracy is a staple. It's a requirement. If it's not accurate, it doesn't make it into consideration. Assuming an arrow and a broadhead combination are accurate, now I'm really focusing, how do I get the most penetration out of a setup? I want two holes. I don't want an arrow clogging either hole, right? Even, you know, halfway out the back exit hole, great. We still got that entry hole. But if I could choose, I would love to have both of them free of obstruction, right? Yep. I've been a part of 2 mile elk track jobs. Unfortunately, half of them we've recovered. Unfortunately, some of them we haven't. And it's just heartbreaking. And so I'm plenty okay with drilling a doe in my food plot with an excessive bow if that means I'm putting more edges in my favor on the elk.
Yep, and I would agree. My experience, playing devil's advocate now too, is what happens when you have shot your 80-plus pound bow? Because, again, we're going to build them hot, right? So, like, my bow came in at 83.5 pounds. I've been shooting that all summer with attacks. Temperatures and conditions in the elk woods, I'm looking, you know, depending on what time of September, you know, mid to low 30s in the mornings, upwards of 95 to 99, even potentially triple digits here in Utah because we start so early. But now if I take that bow and let's say I haven't filled my Kansas tag because that's where I grew up, and I go home over Christmas vacation.
Yeah.
And I go try and do some late season tag filling. And now it's negative 10 when you leave the truck. Then you have a wind chill and you are wearing puffy pants and base layers. And then you're wearing, you know, a Fanatic heavy winter system. And then you've got puffy vest and a jacket on top and you are set for broke. So you can sit 6 hours in the wind and it's, you know, negative temperatures. What's the chance of getting that bow back?
And that definitely changes for everyone. I mean, if I'm Brock Lesnar, probably 100%.
Right.
But I'm not Brock Lesnar. Right. And everyone's got to think about that.
Yeah. And again, you know, are you in a box blind or a pop-up blind where you can take a YoBuddy heater and you can have a heat source and at least make that more comfortable? Or are you in a stand or a saddle? I got into a situation, and this would have been sort of my second year bow hunting. And at the time I was down in Mississippi on a grad school program, and I got into the stand and it was like 20, maybe 23 degrees. I had a 70 pound bow and I was hunting a piece of public ground that was right next to my boss's ground, and doe walks in and I'm just looking for meat and I could not draw my bow back. And so I learned some lessons real quick as to what works for me all summer and spring and into the early fall doesn't work late season when there's frost on the ground or snow on the ground. And sometimes, again, I hadn't shot a bow a lot, not compared to where we're at now. But that's always something to keep in mind, because if you are in exposed situations, what is that 80 pounds going to allow you to do as far as the draw cycle and getting back when you have an animal inside of 20 or 25 yards? You know, how hard are you going to be pulling? How much movement are you going to create for them to bust you? And you get into a late season hunt, as a lot of people know, especially down south, you know, Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, some of those states where those are the most hunted deer in the country, they're not stopping to look at you. They are ducking, turning tail, and running 180 degrees the other way.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Some of those deer get dialed in. I know South Carolina, I think you can hunt year-round if you're in depredation zones. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, those deer are always wired in. And so that was a good point. And, you know, I'm in a unique spot where I think I'm on the same page as you. I want one bow. I want to get familiar with one bow. I want to get very intimate with one bow and know exactly how to shoot it. I don't want, you know, an RX-8 for elk, and then I'm switching over to an Alpha for deer, and, you know, even, or, you know, Matthews this, Hoyt that. I don't like that. I have one shotgun for everything. I have one rifle for everything. And right now I have one bow for everything. Now, 3D season, I'm not pulling 80 pounds through 3D season. I would like to be able to do a push-up when I'm 80. And so I need one bow. And I'm also not a guy that I'm buying a lot of extra tools. Like, we just talked about this at the gym the other night. You know, I don't go buy a second shotgun just because it's, you know, an over-under instead of a semi-auto. And I've always kind of want it. It's like, I have a shotgun and it does at the end of the day, the same thing. I'm not going to buy two.
Yeah. For those of you listening, this is the anomaly, FYI, because I I'm giving you a hard time, Brian, but I agree. Like, if you have a piece of equipment, and again, it's a tool, right?
Yeah.
And if you have one that's working for you, why go get something else? Because am I going to use it? Is it going to be something that sits there? But when it comes to the shotguns, I go get the over and under, dude.
They are cool. I mean, it's probably just because I, you know, life. I'm young. I'm only 29, so it was like, you know, get what you need to get started, and a yeah. lot of it was from family. But then it's like paying for college, and then you're saving up for a house, and then I was buying a wedding ring, and then I was paying for the wedding. Ironically, one follows the other there, and then we bought the farm. So it's always been like, should I dump another $1,000 into a shotgun, or this could be a down payment, or this could be going towards the ring fund. And I agree. A lot of my buddies have a lot more ARs than me. I have zero, but I've also got a 40-acre farmstead and a wife that I love, and not that they don't have leads in those departments, but it's like I just prioritize different, and yeah. we have different paths. But with the bow, it's different. To me, yeah. that's about like being able to shoot well and mm-hmm. getting, you know, I could pick up any rifle and hit 200-yard deer targets like that, and you probably say the same, but 1,000 yards because you got the background. It's not the same with the bow. I can't pick up any bow and be proficient with it right out of the box. And so that's where I want one. Now, I am okay with switching up an arrow. I'm okay with backing off weight mid-season. It gets really tough, like the fourth week of September, coming home from an elk hunt, and now I'm trying to jump into the tree stand right away. Like, that timing is a little bit tight. But, yeah. you know, so I might shoot that elk arrow and that elk setup for a week or two whitetail hunting. But then I'm really taking the time, dial it back, switch arrows, resight in. You know, my bow, I have, I still have my sight dials from my 100 grain tips for whitetail. I ordered new ones when I built my elk arrow. So I just pop that off, pop the other one back on, kind of okay. zero it quick. Things are like, yep, just how I left them. And now I have my whitetail setup.
So you are changing your setup between species.
Yeah.
Even yep. if it's just your point weight from 100 to 125.
Yep, I have. I definitely have. And, you know, I don't see the need even at 70, I would say I'm 30, 72 right now, 71, maybe. I don't weigh it, but it's yeah. maxed out.
It's a heavy 70.
Yeah. yeah. And I just don't see the need to be shooting a single bevel fixed blade on whitetails. I mean, I don't like a 30 yard shot, so I'm usually 25 and in.
Yeah. And I agree. And I'm not a two blade single bevel guy for any species. And again, when you start talking about personal experience, what you have to account for to ensure that you get a entry and an exit wound, okay, is the vein configuration when it comes to the two-blade broadhead, okay? Because if you shoot a two-blade broadhead that has, let's say, an inch and a quarter cut vertically, and let's just say, first off, no bleeders.
Okay? Yeah, mine doesn't. It's a grizzly stick, and I'm not necessarily running, loving that either.
Yeah, if you're running, let's just say most guys are going to be running a three-vein blazer setup, right? That's one of the most common vein configurations.
Yeah.
Okay, a blazer vein is 0.6 or just over half inch tall. You have three of those, so you are over an inch and a half tall on a three-spoke. How are you going to get a triangle through a slot?
Yeah. And my strategy right now is I'm going to break them off.
Okay. You use the right glue. They aren't coming off.
Well, they're the really cheap oil on.
Oh, the quick, quick
fletches. Like,
quick
yeah.
fletches.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they could potentially, in 20, that would have been 2020. I called in a bull for my hunting partner, 29 and a half inch. I think he was a heavy 80. He was like an 81 and a half or 82 pounds on that setup. And literally I dropped back 80 yards. I pulled this bull in and he shot him at 12 with a two blade broadhead with bleeders. And he was running a four fletch setup, and it was the AAE, 23 max. So it's a .32 tall. So it's almost half the height that a blazer is, but four of them.
Yeah.
And at 12 yards with a heavy 80 bow, he didn't pass all the way through the other side because the vein configuration for what the broadhead left did not allow the veins to come through.
Interesting.
They caught on the hide on the offside.
Which so, I think is another testament to just how tough and how big and how dense these animals are. Mm-hmm. Like, no, that setup on a whitetail, he's going to have to dig his arrow out of the ground.
Yeah, but at 12 yards, we shouldn't have found that arrow.
No, that's what I'm saying.
Because of the amount of energy coming through. So, again, it wasn't anything other than the size of the broadhead for the main configuration. Because you fast forward to this last fall, and he shoots that same exact configuration, but changes the broadhead to an expandable 2-inch. And the hole that opened up, we never found that arrow. And that elk was at 30 yards.
Interesting. Yeah, that is cool. So that is really interesting how that can change.
There's a lot of things to take into account when it comes to, again, you want a full pass through. Okay, let's look at not only the broadhead up front, but let's look at what's steering that thing in the back. What kind of hole are we going to create going through to allow everything behind it to follow?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, and we've all, every bow hunter in the world has heard of the Ed Ashby studies and all 13 factors that he found to influence. And everyone takes it at their own level. I know people that follow every 13th rule to a T, and I'm like, well, does that really matter? I don't know. I think some of the things do. I think some of them don't.
Both of them, you're probably good.
Yeah, and he even says, like, hey, this made like a 4% difference, or this other one made like a 20% difference. Like, if your arrow is bigger than your broadhead, like wider, right? Like, you have a wide shaft arrow, like, that's not good. Like, you're not making a big enough hole for your arrow, you're going to get stuck.
Yeah.
And so, does that mean you have to shoot a 4mm arrow?
Yeah.
No, not necessarily.
There's a lot of animals in the past that have been killed with a six or six and a half, which is, you know, quote unquote standard carbon.
Yeah.
And there's a ton that have been killed with a 23 series aluminum Easton.
Yeah. Or a stick. Like,
yep.
For the first 2000 years, it was sticks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then it just comes down to the size of the willow branch or elm that they were cutting.
Yeah. So that was a big one that we talked about. And so that's where I was like, if I did an 80 pound bow, I would probably dial it up for elk. And then I would say, like, my game plan is to bring this back down to 70 for whitetails. And I think that's generally, there's like a 10 pound window, right, that you want to operate in.
Yeah.
So
you can, depending on the manufacturer's length of limb bolts and then the coarseness of the threads, sometimes you can get more than 10 pounds. Every manufacturer will have a 10 pound range there. But generally you can go plus or minus 2 pounds. So, you could expect around 14.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's where I was thinking, like, that would be the game plan. I'd have to spend some time in the backyard, dial everything back in, but at least I'm shooting the same bow. And obviously that's going to be a different arrow too. Like, I have elk hunting arrows and I have, and I'm okay with that, I think. And I think, you know, that's a lot more approachable for the average person than two bows. Right. I mean, bows are an investment. They always have been, but, you know, materials are more expensive. Everything's more expensive. Bows are more expensive too. And it's an investment. Like, this is a long-term durable good that you are going to have for 5 or 10 years likely. And so you don't really want to have to buy two of them just because you like to whitetail hunt and elk hunt.
And bows are one of those things too. Like, if you pay at all attention to the used bow market, bows don't hold their value from year to year, you know. You could buy a gun today and sell it 10 years from now for the same price.
Yeah.
Can't do that with a bow. So, you know, and that's something that we understand too. So I'm a big fan of, you know, find a bow that's going to allow you to do everything. And for me, that's a 34 to a 35 inch axle. I do a 70 pound bow. And again, this year's an anomaly because I wanted to play with some things, but like, my hunting setup is a 70 pound bow, and typically they come in between 72 and 73 pounds, and I can take that out and hunt anything I want with it. 340, 350 spine arrow. It's going to build, depending on the manufacturer and the specific arrow I go with, I'm going to build between 410 and 450 grains. So I'll be shooting anywhere from 292 to about 305.
Yeah. Which is incredible. And that is, to be fair, there's someone out there thinking like, you don't need to shoot 80. And you're right, you don't. My brother has killed the most elk in our entire group. He's shooting a 28 and a half inch draw at 62 pounds because he's like, I just want to draw 70. My shoulders are, you know, I'm older. He's quite a bit older than me. He's like, I don't want to shoot that heavy. And we haven't got passers, but he makes good shots and we find his elk. And so, you know, that definitely don't need 80. I've always been a guy that, you know, I shoot 300 Win Mag because I want extra. I want a margin of safety. Hey friends, if you're listening to this podcast, I know you're an avid hunter just like myself, and we are always looking to get more time in the woods each season. One of the ways that's helped me get more time in the stand is by using Maverick hunting blinds. When I'm comfortable, I stay in the stand longer, and I'm more focused on deer the entire time. I don't turn around so my hood cuts the wind, and I'm not taking shelter from the rain. The best way to stay comfortable is with a hard-sided blind, and my favorite is Maverick's 6-panel Booner blind, which allows me to rifle and bow hunt out of the same blind. The best part is Maverick has a blind for every spot, so whether you're looking for a rifle-only spot or a bow and rifle option or even a round blind to cut the wind resistance down, Maverick has you covered. No matter which option you go with, you're going to be comfortable and sit longer in the stand for all of your upcoming seasons. Go to maverickhunting.com and use the code WESTERNROOKIE, one word, WESTERNROOKIE, to get 10% off your next blind. Want a bullet to be able to make up if I have a little bit of a user error, if I accidentally nicked that front shoulder, and with an arrow, obviously, I'm not banking on an arrow to make up for me hitting a front shoulder, but maybe I do hit a rib. Maybe it's a quartering shot and I got to cut through more animal. I don't want to be riding the razor thin line.
Yep.
Yeah. And so that was one of the topics as well. But then, and then we got into another topic along with this 80 pound trend. You know, I'm shooting a 30. I think, you know, my wingspan is like 6'5". I'm only 6'2". So yeah, my brother always makes fun of me that I got gorilla arms that hang to the ground.
And everybody usually says your height and your wingspan are roughly the same, which they are, right?
Yeah.
However, having a longer wingspan versus your height is the anomaly. So like I'm 5'8", 5'9" on a good day, and my wingspan is less than I am tall. So I'm getting robbed of draw length where you get to see the benefit of it and get more out of your draw. So you're creating more energy because of the wingspan that you have for your draw length.
Right. And I misspoke. I don't think it's 6'5". It's 75 inches. So I think it's like 6'3".
Yeah.
6'5" would be really long. An extra 3 inches would be a lot. But yeah, I shoot with a fairly good bend in my bow arm, and my string is barely touching my nose. I know like certain people at Cam's kind of famous for having hand behind the neck, because that's when he grew up. Like, you didn't get to tune your bows. You had to make it work.
Yeah.
And so I have that fairly good bend. And so I'm thinking like, and I've heard rumors, and this is a rumor, you'd probably be able to dispel it immediately, but the bow shop we go to, one of the guys is a huge Hoyt fan. And he said, yeah, typically Hoyts, you can, they run a little bit shorter. So you might be at that. Like, if you're measuring a 30.5 on a Matthews, you might fit into a 31 Hoyt. And I have no idea if that's true, but.
And there are some, leeways in how a manufacturer can measure them, because that goes back to IBO versus ATA guidelines.
Yeah.
And there's more margin for manufacturing error, if you want to call it that, on the IBO side, just a little more leniency, where on the ATA side, for those manufacturers following it, they are much more strict and stringent on where draw lengths are measured, where draw weights are measured, and how you are getting to all of your numbers. So ATA, being a more strict guideline, says all of our testing will be done at bows that are 70 pounds and you have a 0.2 pound allotment. So you can test a bow that is 70.2, but not 70.3.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay?
For draw length, it is measured from the throw to the grip. Okay. Plus 1.75 or 1¾. Okay. You can have an extra quarter inch. That's it. So 30¼ is where everything is tested. If you go 30.3, you're too low.
Yeah.
And then you have a 5 grain per pound arrow. So 350 grains, that accounts for the 70.2 allotment.
Yeah.
A lot of people think IBO are the same numbers, and it's not. Because IBO, it was set up for 3D. they do not have a draw length requirement. If you want to test a bow at 34 inches, because you can build a bow to 34 inches, you can test it there. When it comes to the weight, you can test an 80-pound bow, and you get a 2-pound extra allotment that you do not have to account for your arrow.
Oh, wow.
It just says 5 grains per pound up to 80 with a 2-pound allotment. So if we built a bow that goes to 32 inches and 80 pounds, then we could build a heavy limb and get it to 82.0 and shoot 32 inches with a 400 grain arrow to give us the 5 grains per pound. And we could advertise that bow as IBO.
Yeah, like a 380 IBO. And it's
screaming compared to what? Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. I never knew the difference. I always just see the IBO ratings, and usually they kind of say like 70-30, and everyone kind of knows that you're like the manufacturers are definitely not going to take the lower edge, right? If it, you know, like you get a 2-pound allotment, that you're not shooting 68, you're shooting 72. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when you look at those, and the question I've gotten asked the most this summer, especially being at all attacks with multiple consumers, is, you know, where can I expect to see speed wise if I'm, you know, this draw length and this weight and this is my arrow? Well, there's a calculator. Okay. And it basically says for every 3.3, I use 3.3. Some guys use 3.5. Every 3.3 grains added to your arrow above 350, you're going to lose 1 foot per second.
Yeah.
For every inch of draw length, you're going to lose 10 feet. I usually say 12, gives me a little bit more room to move. Okay. And then for every 10 pounds, it's 20 feet. So every pound under 70, you lose 2 feet per second. So if you take those numbers, let's say you're shooting a 400 grain arrow, I'm 50 grains under, that's, what is it, 13.337 or something like that. Okay. I'm going to lose, let's say, 14 feet per second. If I shoot a 28.5-inch draw, I'm going to lose roughly 20 because I'm going to go 14 for the draw or 12 for the draw length plus the 6 for the half. That's 18. And then I want to shoot 65 pounds instead of 70. I'm going to lose another 10 feet. And you can now take that off of an ATA bow, and you're going to be plus or minus 5 feet per second. It's going to be a much tighter number because the tolerances of ATA are much stricter. You go try and do that with an IBO and you could be off 15 to 20 feet per second. Just depends on how that manufacturer is measured. Because again, when I shoot a Matthews, I shoot 28, sometimes 27.5 when I was in the shop. In my Hoyts, I'm, depending on the release, 20.25 to 20.75, depending on the head length. Like I gain over half an inch of draw length because of how things are measured and how I set into the bow differently.
Interesting. Is it so when we were going back and forth and you mentioned that about the speed, and another thing you mentioned along with my specific setup is like if I want to go to a 3180, like I'm jumping like 3 spine grades, and so like that's going to add a lot of weight. Like they don't, you know, to get a heavy spine, it's more carbon, and you know, that's the only way you can get it. And you're like, so you're probably not going to see a speed jump. And I was almost like, I'm not doing this to see speed numbers. I'm doing this to put more energy into a projectile,
which is exactly what you're going to see, right? Because if I'm shooting, let's say a 3080, and I'm shooting just say 295 feet per second, and at a 3070, I'm shooting the same speed because now I can shoot a spine down, lighter arrow, but I'm losing the weight.
Yeah.
Off my draw. Okay. There's that balance. So let's just assume that a 3080 and a 3070 are running the same speed because of the arrow spine and weight compensation.
Yeah.
Okay. That 3080 is going to produce more kinetic energy because you have a heavier projectile moving at the same speed. Because your kinetic energy formula is mass times velocity squared. Okay. So right. The mass of your arrow times the speed squared all over a constant of 450,240 if you're running feet per second and grains on an arrow.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I was getting at is like, you know, some people want a speed demon hunting bow and it's like, I don't, I've done the math. Like, I don't, you'd have to like triple an arrow speed to catch a whitetail dropping. And mm-hmm. you're just not going to do it.
It isn't going to happen. Yeah.
No. I've done more research lately, and I'd love to hear your opinions on this because we have a huge whitetail doe problem dropping arrows. I've had it on film, like lighted arrows going right for a top heart shot, don't and I missed shoot 12.
With their head down.
That's exactly. Well, one of them was looking at me, and it still did it. I had it on film. It's looking at me. It was a fawn. I don't know how it got me. But that's exactly what I was going with. Is a lot of people like head down, unalerted deer. It shouldn't know it's coming. And what I was researching was that pivot point that they can leverage with the, raising their head and dropping their shoulders at the same time is phenomenal. Yeah. And then you start looking at
even worse for it.
You start looking at the comparisons like side by sides of like when they're alerted looking at you, they do react a little faster and they go down like this much. Right. Yeah. Versus when they're not, they don't realize it as soon. But when they do, it's like instant. They throw those shoulders down.
Yeah. So when you shoot at an animal, any animal with its head down. And again, I haven't looked at the exact numbers, but there is a significant increase in the speed rating when they can throw that head and drop that back in. And that's elk, deer, antelope, you name it.
Yeah.
So, me personally, I would rather shoot at an animal that has been stopped and is looking to see what's going on. Like, okay, full draw, meh, they stop and they're looking while they're trying to figure out what made the sound and maybe even where it came from. Like, they're not necessarily looking straight at me already, but because they don't have the ability to throw that head and change that lever, then their reaction to go diminishes.
Yeah, I mean, the difference I saw in the research was like it goes from basically a low heart to a high heart the one way versus like a low heart to not hitting the deer the other way. Mm-hmm. It was crazy.
And there's the conversation I love to have around that too is the thought of the no man's land, right? Especially when it comes to antelope. Like that seems to be the bigger animal people talk about. No man's land doesn't exist. Like if you look at the anatomical structure and layout of an animal – the lungs go all the way up into that spine. Yeah. So what is happening for guys to make a high hit and not recover an animal? The majority of what I have seen is that animal is at a water hole. Their head is down. When that shot takes place, head comes up, back end drops out. So gravity is still moving the internal organs down towards the ground into the stomach cavity.
Yeah.
And now you have the separation because they're just floating inside the cavity. So as that animal rebounds, the back is coming up, the internal organs are still dropping because the speed at which that animal is moving can't be compensated for by an internal floating organ system. So the back is already coming up, the organs are still going down. Now you have a void, so you are punching it right through where you should as the animal is already rebounding, coming back up, but the organs are still down here, so you make a clean shot. But there was nothing there for you to go through other than cavity.
Yeah, it would be super cool to see like if there was a way to test that. I don't know how you would do it, but it would be super cool to finally debunk it because I believe it too. Like you got a deer, it's like there is no solid area with nothing. It's you either hit a shoulder blade and you didn't get in. You hit above the spine. On certain animals, there's a lot of area above a spine.
Yeah,
and or you like. Like you said, like everything compressed because that deer dropped and now it's like it hit, it locked, change of momentum in a different direction. And you're, you know, they're at that point, who knows how far down, especially if they don't have air in their lungs. I mean, what is there? Nothing. It's like an empty grocery bag. It's at the bottom.
And it's like shooting at a bedded animal too, right? So if an animal's bedded, just sitting there, you're changing the orientation of the organs because of how that animal's laying on stuff.
Yeah.
So just because you put it right behind the shoulder, well, if their organs are laid over towards the back, you might go right over the top of them and maybe catch the offside lung, depending on how things shift as they sit down.
I've shot enough 3D that I don't want to shoot a bedded animal in real life. I always struggle the most on those bedded buck targets.
Yeah, because
I don't know.
Your tendency, like they are so close to the ground that you tend to like look at the ground, and so you have what's called dip bangs where. Your eye is focusing on the contact point of the bottom of the animal where they're bedded and the ground. I need to get above that. I need to get above that. And so mentally you're looking at the ground. So where does your pin go? right to the ground in the belly line.
Yeah.
So try this sometime, okay? If you guys are out 3D shooting, go to a bedded target, okay? Or go to a target that has some kind of obstruction in front of it, okay? Tack events are great for this because, oh, there's a, you know, mule there at 63 yards and there's a big log in front of him at 47, okay? Add 2 yards, depending on where that obstruction is at in relation to the animal, okay? And aim for the obstruction. Your eye is naturally going to be thinking about it. Your brain is processing, don't hit this, don't hit this. Add a couple yards to your sight, aim hard on it. You're going over the top of it.
Yeah.
You'll make a good shot. That arrow might disappear behind it because you're hitting what you want to hit on that animal, and it just happens to be behind that obstruction.
Yeah, I've done that a lot shooting because that's the elk and scenario. There's always obstructions elk hunting. And so knowing like when I can just aim at a target, you know, 20-40, right? If there's a branch at 20 right where I want my arrow to land, I don't even adjust. I just aim at that branch knowing my arrow is going to go up and over. There's some goofiness when you get too close because your arrow is still coming up into your sight picture. Yep. And unfortunately, I was at full draw on a bull one time and I had a branch at like 2 inches and I couldn't see it in my sight housing. And so stopped this bull with a nervous grunt, had my dial ranged and set and everything. And I touched off. And all of a sudden, the forest around me like exploded because of the branches. Snow started to fall off the branches because we had just got a snow, and my lighted knock just soars right over this bull. And I'm like, oh, finally did everything right, and it didn't work still. And my brother fortunately stepped out and made a shot on that bull, and we got him. So at least we got to bring the bull home, but it was a bummer. It was definitely a bummer.
Now your brother gets to rub it in your face that I got him and you didn't.
So my brother has shot more elk than me. But I'm batting a 315 average, so
that's a good one to have.
We both have our pros and cons.
Yeah,
I've done only mine with a rifle though, which is not too much to brag about. And he likes to point out you had 2 once-in-a-lifetime tags. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, that's another. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. He's like an over the counter. He always says a over the counter raghorn with a bow is cooler than your 350 on a lifetime license.
Yeah, there's definitely different challenges to each one of them. So
yeah,
because you pull that once in a lifetime. Like, okay, what kind of bulls are in the unit?
I had a 400. I was videoing a 400.
You go in and try and kill that 400. Depending on the time of year and how many cows he's got and how many satellites are running around, like that's a heck of an accomplishment. I don't care if it's public land or not.
It was like, public that's just land. The way it is. And I didn't even know how to score elk. I sent it to Ryan Carter and I'm like, hey, this, I keep getting like 400, 390, 400. Am I even close? Or am I just like another guy on the internet that thinks he's got a 400 inch bull? And he sent me a voice note back, which I was really surprised about. And he's like, dude, that thing is a monster. Like every time I look at him, he gets bigger. My first guess was high 80s. Now I'm thinking high 90s. Like you just got to shoot him.
Yeah. So you're in the ballpark. You just need to get posted up and dial on him.
Yeah, he moved. He moved to private land, and a private landowner shot him in North Dakota. This was all in North Dakota. But beautiful 7x8. And his, like, seventh, all of his, he didn't have one shorter than 15. Like, it wasn't like he had a couple nubs on the end to get 7x8. Like, everything was just a beautiful bull. I ended up shooting that 354 clean 6x6. So, I'm tickled pink, man. But it was a crazy hunt to see bulls like that. Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it was – September 8th, season opened, any weapon in the Badlands.
So you cheated the best time to be out there with a bow, and you had a boomstick in your hand. I'm echoing your brother then.
To be fair, it would have been a very difficult unit to bow hunt. I mean, it's like breaks, Montana break.
Yeah, wide open.
Wide open.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, people do it. I don't want to say I couldn't. I don't think I had the skills at that time that were required to pull it off or a partner. So, I wish I do believe like shooting stuff with your bow is so much cooler, man. I love it. That rush you get where you're holding, you're in charge, it's not on a bench. It's not on a pack with a tripod and a 25 power scope. Like you are holding this and you are actively fighting your heart rate and your adrenaline and you're trying to keep this pin where it needs to be and make a good shot and remember everything and you're at 20 yards. No matter what the animal is, it's so much more thrill trying to do it with a bow. Even whitetail does. I just love it.
I agree 100%. Whitetail does. They melt me, dude. just most of the time, again, the whitetail bucks I've killed, it's like, oh, crap, he's right there. Wait, draw. Okay, 2 minutes, it's over. Whitetail does, you see them, and they come in, and they're strolling, and they're taking their time. And you spend 45 minutes watching them close the distance and get to in front of you. And by that point, I'm just like, oh, is this finally going to happen? I just start shaking. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Yeah, well, I have a hard time shooting does. I love doing it, but they wreck me.
My wife, when she got done with residency last summer, she was shooting an old bear, and she's left-handed. And it was tough, and it didn't have – and we knew, like, hey, you know, this bow can work, but they've come a long ways. And I knew – and so we shot one day trying to get ready for season. I'm like, hey, you just shot your bear. Let's go to the shop and shoot a couple new bows just to kind of see what, you know, what you like and what you don't. We don't have to buy or anything. But, of course, I knew what was going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. You go start shooting the new stuff. You're like, man, this feels sweet.
Yeah.
And sure enough, she picked
a lot. And
they had a left-handed VTM there, and she picked it up. And she picked up a Phase 4, and she just like, hey – and she visibly drew different. They're both set at 50 on the shell, or, you know, they dialed them both back to 50 for her because she hasn't shot in 2 years, and she's a smaller girl. And so she draws back, and the VTM, she just straight drew it. Almost arm out, pull from there, not like pushing and pulling, not sky drawing. The Phase 4 was visibly like she had to do that a little bit. And then we started thinking like, well, do we order a 50-60? And the guy's like, I've never seen a female draw like that. Based on like you saying you haven't shot in 2 years other than today. Mm-hmm. He's like, I think you should just dial it up to 60 and see how it feels. And if that works, you can just take this one home, a 60-70, and shoot it at 60. So we dialed up to 60. No different. Just nice.
Dude, that's, you know, not to toot Hoyt's horn or engineer's horn, but that's the HBX system.
Yeah.
Like
it was,
you know, our big thing this year, especially with the new cam system, is our 70 feels like 60, you know, and that's
hold true for the 80 too.
Honestly. Yes. Yep. I've had a number of guys, cause we've got an 80 pounder in the trailer for the tag events. It is our number one most shot and even asked about though. So guys get there and they've already heard it from a friend or someone else already shot it. It's like, you need to go over there and shoot this 80 pounder. That is our number one asked for and shot product in the TAC trailers this year, is our 80 pounder.
Is that cam system on all of the 2023, 2024 bows, or is it only on like the RX series or?
The RX series, so the 8 and the Ultra, and then it is also on the Alpha X series, so the 30 and the 33.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's, yeah. That's the HBX Exact, which allows for quarter inch draw length adjustments, 75, 80, and 85% let offs. And then you have two back wall options. And then the previous version, which is the HBX Pro, is on the high line. So that's our bow that's going to go to 34 inches for draw length ranges. And then we have the Eclipse, which is our female and younger archer design bow, and our Torx series. And those, so the Torx series and the Eclipse, are still in a cam and a half system, because we can get better performance for the shorter draw length ranges out of those bows right now with that system.
Yeah. And so that's what she said. She's like, this thing shoots so smooth. We're going Hoyt VTM. And now she gives me crap because I'm still shooting a Matthews. But after seeing her success, I'm like, I really do want to start shooting a lot more Hoyts and probably go that direction in the future. And, but yeah, that buck came in like the doe, like he's going the other direction on our ridge. I called at him. We were sitting together. He slowly turns, start meandering in, closing the distance. I mean, this is like 5-6 minutes. Comes into 15 yards, turns broadside and stops. And she just, bah! And I'm like, oh, great shot. I mean, obviously in the moment, I'm like, great shot. And then I'm thinking back, like, if you would have let him take one more step, we would have had that on video on our trail camera. But the way it worked out was perfect. But she was a stone cold killer. Like, just, dude, I'm like, did you get buck fever or not? And she's like, and then as soon as she shot, she started like doing the shivering.
Yeah, it's women. And I don't know what it is. I can't explain it. I've competed with a lot of them with my background in rifle shooting. And dude, they just, their ability and their mental capacity to start blocking stuff out and just focus on the situation, what's going on. It's incredible. Like, you know, again, you know, being married, like, you understand, like, they have so many things going on and there's so many things being processed at any given time that they can be and I don't want to say crazy, but just so stressed out and emotional about the volume of stuff going on in their mind. When my wife gets in a stand or is hunting with me, there's nothing else going on. I've had 177 inch buck walking. She got to full draw and she's just on him. And I'm like, you ready to stop him? Not yet. I need him to take two more steps. This is where I want to shoot him. Like, she's telling me I want to shoot him here, not there.
Wow.
Because her body is telling her this is where I'm comfortable. This is where it's going to be. And it's just like, okay. And yeah,
I would have been nervous to stop him.
She shoots, he runs off. Okay, good shot. And then, of course, it was a, okay, well, I saw the arrow here. And I was like, no, that's just you. Again, that buck fever moment, like everything happened so quick after that. That's not where the shot was. It was here. He's right there. He's dead. We already watched him fall. Okay. And then it was a, oh, what just happened? But like all through that, and even right after the shot, it was just, it wasn't my wife. It was a completely different person that was in so laser focused control of herself and the moment that I wouldn't have wanted to mess with her. Like, she just screwed somebody up.
Wow. That maybe that is what it is. Cause I remember thinking like, man, like I could tell, like she wasn't like, when I shoot, I'm like trying to hold it together. Like I'm trying not to fall apart and melt. And then she was just like, her bow arm was steady, everything. And then she, this is going on, like her broadhead was like 3 inches from my nose because we were in the same tree, right? And so I'm like, not quite, but I'm like, I had a front row view of it all. I really should have filmed, but I was worried about stopping him on time. And she, nope, just he stopped for a split second to eat an acorn and she shot him.
Yeah. It was killers.
It was incredible.
And
she shot more deer than me last year.
Like that so. Has been. And it could just be like, that's just, again, it's in their psyche, but like, I don't think my wife in that situation realized the magnitude or what was really going on as far as the size of this animal. Like my eyes are saucers and I'm like, you have no clue what's going on right now. Like I'm shaking, holding the camera, like trying to keep things steady. Cause I know like, this is the buck we've been coming in here to try and get, and he's right in front of us. Like everything is coming together finally. And, okay, that's the one. Yep, that's the one we want. Okay, right there. I want him right here. Okay, fine.
I wonder if that's like we do ourselves a disservice by like how much we think all year long about this deer and you know, just like obsessing over it so that when it happens, it's like larger than life. And my wife, she likes to hunt, and I'll show her trail cam pictures and be like, oh, cool. But she doesn't check our cell cams.
Yeah,
you know, she just lets me tell her if there's a buck on there, and so
he
maybe
looks,
that's
he
like
looks good. I like him.
Yeah, basically, yeah. We got an 11 pointer running around in the backyard most nights, and yeah, okay, cool. Glad he's still here. You know, when we go out and he walks, I was like, well, of course he walked out. Like we're hunting. What?
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Yeah, he's not gonna show up, man.
Yeah. Well, awesome, man. I appreciate the insight to a lot of these questions. I feel like it's just so common to hear the 80-pound bow topic, and people are thinking, I think a lot of people think they want that. And I think there's just a couple questions that you brought up that you really want to ask before you dive in and make a lifetime investment. I know you could back it back down to 70 and be right back where you started, but just a lot of things to think about before you drastically change up your setup. And you know, I wouldn't want anyone to go out and buy a bow, no matter what brand it is, thinking they wanted something and then not having all the pieces of information, and then they get it and they're like, oh, I don't know. This is what I wanted.
Yeah. And trying to avoid buyer's remorse and that feeling of maybe this isn't what I wanted to do. And now I've got to back stuff off and change drawings and tweak and play and do some stuff here and there to make it fit the way I want at the poundage I'm more comfortable at. So
yeah. Order new arrows. We've got 2 weeks before an elk hunt. I don't know. Or get, God forbid, get to a stand and a 177 walks out and you can't pull your bow back. I mean, oh my Lord, that's not a recipe for a good night.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, no, I really appreciate coming on, sharing some of that insight and giving, and also the technology. I'm really interested in that. So it's an ATS Max now. Is that what's the cam called?
HBX.
HBX.
Exact.
Oh, So the other one was Pro. I had an X. I knew there was an X in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the HBX is the Cam series. And then, so we had the HBX, and then that migrated to HBX Pro for second generation. And then the Exact is our third generation.
And is that kind of playing on the quarter inch adjustability to like really get exactly where you need to be? Can you hear me? We had a little.
There we go. Sorry about that.
Is the Exact the like a little play on the being able to dial in like your quarter inch adjustability in your back wall and just really fine tune that to you?
Yeah, that's exactly where it came from. Is the ability for our end consumer to be able to adjust and customize everything to exactly what he is looking for. So the quarter inch draw lengths, the multiple runoff options, and then the back wall feel. And you can do all that without the use of a press. So if you've got T15 Torx, you can change that draw length by a quarter inch and play plus or minus. Well, am I really 28 and a half, or how does 28 and a quarter feel? How does 28 and three quarters feel? And so there's, it gives a lot more potential and possibility to really figure out what you like as an archer.
Yeah, that's awesome. And you did mention that's on the new RX-8s, the RX Ultra, and the Alpha X. You can get that cam system.
Yep, those four models.
I was thinking, you know, based, so a 30-inch bow, does that mean you could get to like 30 and a quarter, or is it really stop at 30? Or sorry, like the RX-8, I believe, only it says 30. Like, is that truly the last option?
It is on that module, so yes.
Okay.
Now, could you manipulate? Yeah, it should measure like 30 and a quarter off the factory floor because, again, using HEA guidelines, we're allowed to have that quarter inch. So we're going to try and build just a little bit into it. So there's no 30 and a quarter setting built into the bow. 30 is your last one. But if you put it on a draw board, it will come in just a little.
And the RX-8 doesn't have a module for a 31-inch draw, right?
Correct. No, your Ultra Wood, and then your Alpha X33.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I want to play around with some of the options. I don't know which one will fit me the best, but I'm really excited to really take that next level and find. I feel like I have like just a hammer. Like here's a hammer, and you can use it to break concrete. You can use it to put in pole barns. You can use it for finish nails. But it's just generally. I feel like I just have that general bow right now, and I really want like a bow for me. That's that next step I'm getting towards. Real quick, I don't want to hold you up too long.
No,
you mentioned that for you, the one size fits all everything. You went to a 35-inch ATA.
33 to 35, depending on what we have in the line for an option.
And I don't hear a lot of people talk about that at all.
Yeah. And again, so my background, you know, being in math and statistics is my degree. Trying to find one bow, I want to figure out and optimize my draw length for that specific bow. So back when I was in a shop, I had one bow for the year, and I was doing indoor spots, outdoor field, 3D, and I was trying to hunt with it. So to get the benefits for the target side I was doing, I needed a longer bow that did not hinder my capacity and my abilities as a hunter. So that 35-inch actual axle is really what gave me that versatility where I can get in a ground blind or I can get in a tree stand. I can go spot and stalk with a 35-inch bow. And it truly gave me more benefits than it ever hindered me, right? I typically cut a little bit more generous lanes in my stands. And if I'm in a blind, I sit back towards a corner with a 28-inch draw. You know, that literally at full drop put my hand in that bow perfectly under the peak of that ground blind. So it gave me the most room, and I've never had issues with a 35-inch bow in a hunting situation. And now when I go to do any kind of target, indoor, outdoor, you name it, I've got a 35-inch bow that gives me a better actual platform for holding and gives me a better upright head position because of the string.
Interesting. Yeah. I just never really hear a lot of people talk draw weights. A lot of people used to talk brace heights, and I feel like the brace height topic is really diving off with how efficient and smooth shooting bows are lately. And so it's really draw weights and draw lengths and like IBO, ATA speed ratings. I don't really hear people say like, this is the right axle to axle to me, unless you get crazy long. Like no one's shooting a 28 in ATA with a 34 inch draw.
Right.
Yeah. And your draw lengths should always be shorter than your axle to axle. Right. So if you have a 30 inch draw length, I never recommend you shooting a 30 axle to axle. Because that actual axle measurement is taken at brace or at rest, which means once you come to full draw and you now induce load into that system, your limbs are compressing. So you're shorter on your actual axle, right? Your cam to cam might be longer, okay, because of how cams roll over in the design. So you're coming off the top edge of the cam versus coming from your axle. So that can allow a little higher string position. But the longer you get with a shorter bow, the more acute or the more steep that string angle becomes. When you're shooting out on a flat surface, like if you're just shooting in your backyard, standing in the pad of your garage, shooting 20 yards, even out to 80 yards, okay, you're not going to notice a whole lot because that string's going to come right to the corner of your mouth, off the tip of your nose, and you're going to have a nice upright head position, and you're taking out a lot of those external environmental factors. But now you take that same bow that's got a short axle to axle, even at my draw length. You know, last year I hunted with a release that allowed me to shoot a 28 inch draw. So I ran a 30 inch axle to axle bow. But if I go to shoot out of a tree stand and I'm 20 feet up or 25 feet up and I'm shooting 7 yards straight down, when you come into anchor and you now come at a very, very steep angle down, you lose that contact with your nose unless you really start craning the head down. So for me, another benefit is when I'm in a mountain scenario coming over the top spot and stock on a mule and I'm shooting a severe angle down, or in a tree stand shooting a severe angle down on a whitetail, having that longer axle-to-axle keeps the string up towards my face so I don't have to bend and maneuver and kind of negotiate my head in a situation to stay in my peak.
Yeah, which is all about like keeping your consistent form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm pretty sure I have a 30. I'm pretty sure that, I don't know, you probably know better than me. I think the original Halons were 30s because they had the Halon 32.
Yeah, Halon 32 is second generation.
Right. So I think, you know, that's why I think the other one was 30. Otherwise, it would have been the Halon 30.
Yeah.
And I have a 30 inch draw. So I probably am in that danger zone.
And you probably have a really severe string. If you have your wife take pictures of you at full draw, that string is probably laid way down away from your nose.
Yeah.
Which is why you're not making contact.
I have to think about touching it, like for sure doing that. So
So you're either, I call it peacocking, right? Where you take your entire head and you slide it forward trying to make that contact, or you've got to like tilt that chin way down and like lean that nose down into it. And so from an optical nerve, which is your eye, okay, when you have to take your head position and tilt it down towards the string, okay, if your eye is looking straight out on level ground, that's its neutral position. As soon as you shift your head and now your eye is having to look up out of the top of the socket, you are now creating an excess of eye fatigue and strain because the blood flow is now reduced going into your optical nerves. So essentially what happens is when you tilt your head down and you look through the top of your eye socket, the rate at which your eye fatigues is increased significantly. So when you are looking and aiming at your target, there is now an increased delay between what is actually happening downrange and what your eye is telling your brain is there. So if you ever come to full draw and you're holding and holding and holding and trying to execute and that head is way down and you're pulling, finally the shot breaks, let's say 20 seconds in, and then you go look and it's like, well, that's not where my pin was at. And so you start making sight adjustments. Is that really where your pin was at, or did you float out and there was a delay between what you were really seeing and what your brain was being told was there? And again, we can go into all that because I dove so deep into that on the competitive rifle side because of natural head position, where I had to be and knowing like my best shot window had to be within this time frame down to tenths of a second. because of the delay and the eye fatigue that I was experiencing. And then now you couple that with now you're on a, you know, a Western elk hunt and you're at a higher elevation and you're only drinking 2 or 3 liters of water a day. So you're already dehydrated on top of it. There's a lot of those external factors that guys don't take into account.
Wow. You're really selling me on the fact that I should get a different setup.
I think you should.
By the way, my bow is white and blue, which are like the only two shades of color that really stand out to cervids.
Inside grayscale with undulates. Yep.
Yeah. And so, white camo with all blue accessories probably wasn't the wisest choice coming out of college. Yeah.
But if you hunt in the snow, you'd blend in better.
Yeah, but I hunt in a tree in the snow. So I mean, it's still... Yeah, my next bow is not going to be white. I haven't picked a color yet. It's hard to go away from black. Black is cool, but I don't know. Either a black or a camo or a tan or something more universally accepted in the elk woods.
That tombstone looks really, really good in dark timber and aspen.
Oh, yeah, that could be it.
So,
that could
and
be
then
the
you
one.
get up into a cottonwood or a walnut or an elm or and a good oak flat. Disappears pretty well.
Awesome. Well, thank you once again, Evan, for being here today, sharing all this information, and thank you for listening.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.